from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, are music downloads dead? With so many people streaming music through services like Pandora and Spotify, the big boys in tech, namely Apple and Google, have risen from the sidelines to join the fray. What does it take to make a profit in this new world of music? Who are the winners and losers? Can we be sure the consumer comes out on top? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Streaming music is not a profitable business yet, but you'd be hard-pressed to know it, given the recent rush to market by big tech companies like Apple and Google. They're following consumers who are flocking to services like Pandora and Spotify, and that's where the pundits say the possibilities for future profits lie. That is, for everybody, it seems, but the new and undiscovered musicians who used to be able to rely on royalties. Music, technology, advertising, where is it all going? That's what we're talking about this hour. Joining us now, we have in studio Larry Marcus, managing director of Walden Venture Capital. He was also a founding investor of Pandora when it was still called Savage Beast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
And on the phone, we have David Hyman, founder and CEO of Moog, an online music subscription service. He sold the company to Beats by Dr. Dre. He was also the CEO of Gracenote, the world's music database and music ID service. He's currently the founder of Hymco. Did I say that right, David?
That's correct.
Well, thank you both for being here. I guess I'll start with you, Larry Marcus. What's your initial response to the product that it sounds like Apple is about to unveil?
Well, it's a little bit like asking me how soft Sasquatch's fur is, because I've never seen Sasquatch, and it's very difficult to, you know, give a hug and feel how soft it really is. But it certainly is going to be very validating if it's a radio product of the radio space overall, and I hope that it's really going to drive more consumer awareness of radio to bring us from about 10% of radio being internet listening or over IP listening to much higher percentages, which is going to create much more opportunity in the category.
From what I've read ahead of the Apple Developers Conference that's coming up in a few days, Apple is actually going to follow the model of Pandora, but presumably adding its own power in terms of advertising. It's already got a cohort of advertisers lined up. And, of course, the functionality it might offer with the iTunes library. You know, it will have presumably the ability, to tell that Rachel likes Tuvan throat singing, for instance, and offer suggestions along that score. Why doesn't Apple just go ahead and buy Pandora, do you think?
Well, I think whether or not they would ultimately decide, you know, to attempt to acquire Pandora, it's just a really different conversation, and maybe that's something they've considered. But Pandora is certainly just focused on driving its own business and, innovating for consumers. But on your question on the model, you know, Pandora's model is really around advertising, and with a small piece that's subscription, but it's primarily advertising. And if Apple is going after an advertising-driven model, then one thing that's going to do for the category is make advertisers think more and more about radio as a programmatic part of their buying, which means that when you're thinking about reaching consumers, you want to reach them as an advertiser. You're thinking, you know, radio, TV, outdoor, the mass media. Kind of the digital radio moves out of being kind of acute new media aspect of the media buy into more part of the mainstream, that starts opening up that $15 billion terrestrial radio pie of advertising to the internet radio market. And Pandora is working strongly on opening up those local markets, which is really three quarters of that pie as well. So I really feel like the biggest issue with internet radio right now is that people on the mass market don't really know it that well. I mean, in Silicon Valley and with the digital technorati, you know, people understand that the phone is in fact an internet radio device, but in the broad mass market, that's not as known.
Do you think that's the case, David Hyman, that your average rank and file music listener doesn't really understand you can get music from your smartphone?
You know, I'll have to slightly disagree there. I think, you know, if you look at the numbers of Pandora and the people that it's reached, I think it's somewhere in the 200 million range. I think most consumers today are probably aware of online radio, and some of the more, you know, mass market consumer music services like iTunes and Spotify. You know, I think the challenge here for Apple is it's a bit out of their core competency. They've tried to do things like this in the past. Outside of iTunes a year ago or 2 years ago, they launched something called Ping, which was a music discovery platform, a social network.
I remember that. That came and went, didn't it?
It came and went. And so, you know, my guard is up here. Sometimes Apple hits a home run, and sometimes they don't. When it comes to them buying Pandora, you know, it just doesn't seem like it's in Apple's DNA to buy third-party entities that already have a significantly strong established brand. I just can't see Apple carrying another company's brand name.
What about Google? I mean, Google has come out, of course, with its own Play Music All Access for Android phones. Why don't they just buy, say, Pandora or Spotify or Rhapsody or any one of a number of services?
You know, I think they could. A lot of times these companies have to try and fail multiple times before they throw in the towel and buy something. And that was certainly the case with Google before they bought YouTube. They had tried to compete for a while. They had launched their own video platform, which ultimately failed, and then they succumbed and bought YouTube. So we'll see what happens here. I think it's great for consumers that there's more choice. A lot of small companies have not been able to get into the online radio space because the statutory rates created by the labels and the artists are too high for most companies to think about entering the space. You have to have mass scale to make these kinds of businesses work.
Well, let's look at things now from a consumer perspective. Larry Marcus, take us through some of the major services like Pandora, Spotify, Rhapsody. Just elevator pitch for each. What pros and cons? What is it? Why is it you would want to sign up with any one of those,
sure,
one over the other?
So people really love music. It's a huge passion center. And I love to say we all love music. It's just a question of to what extent. So there's a lot of different modes that people think about finding music. Like if you're just wanting to hear great music right now and you just want to hear that next great song, that's really what radio is all about. And radio has actually been 70% of the overall listening pie. And Pandora is actually the top three in terms of time spent in the on the iPhone, for example. So up there with Google and Facebook, it's just a lot of time spent listening to the actual radio. But sometimes you're thinking, you know, I want to hear some great Led Zeppelin. I want to hear Heart. I want to hear more of, you know, the Civil War as some band that I'm interested in digging into more. And that's where it's really great to go to one of the all-you-can-eat music services, you know, Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, Dave's company, Mog. And those all-you-can-eat music services are really also appeal to people who like being a DJ and creating their own playlists. And then there's iTunes, where like my daughter loves to buy songs on iTunes, and she's hearing about things and buying all the time. And when we're in the car, she likes being the DJ with those songs. So, I mean, ownership is another mode. And there's other modes altogether, like you're hearing a song on the radio and you're wondering what it is, in which case you'd use SoundHound to identify the song and then watch the live lyrics scroll along with the music and sort of turn into live karaoke. So I don't think it's the kind of thing where one service really covers the full value proposition. Sometimes you're in this more passive mode. You want to hear great music, and then suddenly you want to zoom in and you want to learn more about the artist, get more discovery. Sometimes you want to connect more with the band. You know, when are they playing? When are other things happening? That's when something like a band page gets very exciting. You go visit their band page and you have that direct connection.
Joining us now, we have Greg Sandoval on the phone, senior reporter for The Verge, an online tech news publication. Thank you for being here, Greg.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know how much of that you just heard. We've been talking about the relative merits of all the different online streaming services, each of which seems to serve a different function and may serve a different function for the same listener, depending on what he or she wants to get into at that moment. Is that your sense of things?
Absolutely. I mean, right now there's plenty of different players out there, and they're all trying to find a special niche to differentiate themselves. So they're going to be offering different things and to draw listeners. It's a good time to be a music fan right now because music has never been cheaper and there's never been an easier ways to access it.
You know, reading about on Apple's latest foray, which we still don't know the full shape of, I see a lot of people poo-pooing iTunes. You know, that's the old school way of doing it, owning music. That's for, I don't know, grandparents or something. But, you know, as we just heard from Larry Marcus, his daughter likes to do it that way. And it's a $17 billion a year business that costs $5 billion to run. Isn't there still a little juice left in iTunes, Greg Sandoval?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not going anywhere. It has, though... It looks a little stale compared to some of these new services, right, who are giving you complete and total access to, you know, tens of millions of songs. So when you think about buying one song for really a dollar, rather than having access to millions of songs for, what, $10 to $12 a month, or I guess I'd say $8 to $12 a month, depending on the service, it just looks a little kind of stale, right? People are kind of saying, oh, okay, that's not a great deal compared to some of the newer services. So Apple is trying to, with the radio, iRadio, trying to make it a little sexier. They're trying to make it a little bit easier for people to find new music without dumping the downloads model.
Well, I have to ask, you mentioned sexier. David Hyman, when you're talking to business people, sexy means profitable. Who's got an idea that seems likely to make a profit in the near future?
Well, you know, it's all about scale with these businesses. The labels and the artists take such a disproportionate piece of the pie. You know, in many ways, I've felt like they're biting the hands that feed them. It's very hard for companies to enter this space and not become profitable with mass scale. So an Apple or a Google, they can pull it off. There have been a number of other companies that have found models that are doing incredibly well. There's SoundCloud, which I'm super bullish on. Larry had mentioned the companies that he was a personal investor in. But there are many other companies that are doing interesting things in the space. I think interesting and sexy about the iTunes possible approach is the incredible amount of data that they're sitting on with regards to everyone that's ever touched iTunes. They've been running a product called Apple Genius, which is actually powered by my alma mater, Gracenote, that's been scanning music lovers' hard drives to help build profiles of what's in their collections and make recommendations in the iTunes store. I would imagine that they will now use that data to power their radio service and make it really easy for them to intuitively know what you want to listen to and create an engaging radio experience.
I wonder whether they're going to put a little more programming oomph into Genius. I have to say, I find that it doesn't actually have great recommendations unless the song I've picked to bounce off of is a pop song. If it's any other kind of genre, it often doesn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think they've been somewhat limited to making recommendations to things that they have available in the store. But you can imagine with a radio application, they could also be playing songs that you already know and love. And when it comes to radio, most people don't want to just listen to college radio where every song is a song they don't know. People like their comfort zones. They want to hear the songs that they already know and love, probably more than 50% of the time in a radio stream.
Speaking of songs you know and love, we're calling out to the listeners. Join the conversation. Tell us what you're listening to and why, what you love about it. You can give us a ring at 866-733-6786. I'll say that again now that you have your pen. 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. You can go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Add your comments there. Also, our Facebook page. We're checking our Facebook page as well. Larry Mark, because let me ask you, you know, we haven't really talked about the way Spotify works just yet. It seems more of a sort of social approach in the sense that you can clue in and see what your friends are listening to. Boy, I spend so much time on Facebook. It seems like the Facebook for music. I don't know if that is a model that is expanding at the same rate that Pandora is.
Well, Spotify had a big problem with essentially spamming their users, the friends of their users, with their feed. So as it turns out, just because you're friends with somebody, it doesn't really mean that you care what they listen to. Musical compatibility is a very complex thing, and that turned into a bit of a novelty. Oh, I can't believe you're listening, you know, to Linda Ronstadt. I can't believe you're listening.
So in other words, people could be using it to feel smug about their friends' choices.
Right. A lot of people are trying to figure out how do they turn that feed off. But there's a lot of different approaches to attempt to try to figure out how to recommend things. And certainly your friends can be a good source. And we all deeply value that friend who we know that can tell us a band. And we listen to that band and we feel really passionate about it. Part of the magic of great radio and great personalized radio is it really delivers you that great next song. It understands exactly, like Dave was saying, that mix of things that are familiar versus things that are new and paces them out correctly. And doing a great playlist and being a great DJ and doing that on mass scale with mass customization is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And, you know, that's just something that's all Pandora does is focus on that. And, you know, Apple, they're trying to do a lot of different things as a part of their brand. You know, what does the Apple brand really mean? I think to most people, it means a great device. What does a Pandora brand mean to people? Well, it should mean great music, ease of use, accessibility everywhere on all your devices, not just on an iPhone, but off of your Samsung DVD player or off of your Vizio TV, off of your Xbox game console. So lots of different access points as well.
I should also mention that you can on Spotify listen to whatever you want. It's not a solely social kind of search engine. Greg Sandoval, do you get the sense that curation is a big driver in the music business, or is it more like Larry Marcus says, something where you're seeking experts or your own tastes to be reflected back to you in an algorithmic way?
I do believe that. People are looking for a way to discover new music, right? I think that's one of the big roadblocks here. With all this music, and we have oceans of music available to us, you still got to figure out what's good, what you like. And we've always had radio, right? Or I guess people who read Rolling Stone and, you know, music lovers would go to some of the experts. People that they like their taste, they share some kind of common taste. And now we don't really have an easy way. All this technology, and there's not really an easy way to find new music. But supposedly they're getting better at this, you know, with these search algorithms. I do think, though, that people do tend to still look for people with similar tastes and people who follow stuff closely and pick up ideas for new music from them.
You know, this would be a good moment to go to the phones. We're already getting some phone calls. And we've got Lou and Milbrae.
Yes, hi. I'm in the music business. I'm a recording engineer and producer, and I just heard one of your guests there talk about all the technology. The problem is the technology that they use is based on searching and all this other stuff. In the meantime, we spend an awful lot of time and money in the studio turning out high quality audio, and it gets ruined by MP3 and all of the systems that are used to download to the general populace. I'm surprised that nobody has taken some time to come up with a way to have high quality audio available, but they don't. It seems to be nothing more than quantity and not quality.
Well, that sounds like a question for David Hyman.
Yeah. I'll say that MOG, my alma mater music subscription service, we were kind of at the forefront of that. We offered the highest resolution bitrate of any of the music subscription services. And for the last 3 months, you'll be happy to know I've been consulting for a company called Pono, which is founded by Neil Young, who's obsessed with this issue and is working arduously on launching a new download store that will allow consumers for the first time to have access to music in the full resolution in which it was recorded, even better than what your processor and your Macintosh can play back. And so for the real hardcore music lover who wants to hear all the detail, I believe they'll have some better choices coming soon.
Does that set your mind at ease, Lou?
Well, yeah, I know what Neil Young's doing. I've actually talked to him about the thing, and I hope that actually works out. The problem is you got to deal with Apple and other people who don't care about the quality. They just care about getting as much stuff down the pipe in as little data as possible.
It does seem, Larry Marcus, as though most people just don't really care about the difference between, you know, a rich, full audio file and an MP3 with the top just sliced right off.
I share the frustration, and I'm also a musician and playing a number of bands and record for fun. Luckily, I get to hear the music in its raw form, and that's a wonderful thing. But that's one of the dark, dirty secrets about the digital age is you've gone from a super high fidelity LP down to a CD, which actually is about a megabyte of bandwidth, if you're looking at it. To most, like a Sirius or XM satellite stream, you're getting about 30K. So it's just, you know, a 30th of the resolution that you'd even get on a CD. So, MP3s are just sadly very difficult from a sound quality perspective.
Ironic that we're spending all this money on high-quality headphones to listen to very, very tiny files. Folks, we're talking about online radio this hour. We're about to take a short break and come back. We want to hear from you. How do you listen to music and why? How much advertising can you take between the songs? Do you care how much the musicians make? Join our conversation, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your thoughts and questions on Facebook. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about internet radio this hour, and we have with us now Zach Rogue, an Oakland-based the founder of an Oakland-based indie band called Rogue Wave. Their fifth studio album, Nightingale Floors, was released yesterday. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I don't know how much of this conversation you've been listening into, but one of the biggest issues with internet radio is how the people who provide the content, the music, get paid. And I'm curious what you think about the situation with royalties on all of these services.
Well, I think there's an understanding of musicians that it's a rapidly evolving time. I know there's going to be an announcement that out soon. I think a lot of people are bracing themselves for what that means.
It sounds, Zach, like your phone is breaking up a little bit. We're going to see if we can't get a better connection and come back to you in just a moment. Larry Marcus, you know, I guess we heard David Hyman say earlier that that a lot of companies find the royalty requirements onerous, especially, you know, if you are a small company that doesn't have deep pockets. But it seems wrong not to pay the musicians, the labels, the folks that own the copyrights.
Absolutely. And again, as a musician, I think it's really important for people to be paid for their trade. It's important to look at a broader perspective. If you look at radio, radio has always been about promotion. You'd want to get your songs on the radio to get heard. And then when people have sampling, that leads to purchase. So one of the great aspects about personalized radio versus terrestrial is these huge playlists. So you have literally over 100,000 different artists getting played on Pandora every month who would never be paid. Sorry, who would never be played on any other terrestrial radio or other radio format. So there's a much deeper level of discovery. In addition, versus terrestrial radio that's probably paying somewhere in, you know, maybe 3-4% royalties back to the different stakeholders, a very small amount off of this $15 billion industry, the internet radio companies are paying in excess of 50 or 60% or more of revenues back out. And actually, even Spotify, these direct companies are paying up to 80% or more of revenues back. So just the transition from analog to digital radio is changing a regime where the artists are getting very little or nothing, essentially, to where they're actually getting paid.
Well, we've got Zach Rogue back with us on the phone. So what is your sense? I think as we lost you last time, you were just talking about how everything is really in flux right now.
It is. And, you know, and there's, I think what this has done is it's also, it's really changed the discussion in a lot of ways, and it's opened a lot of doors. You know, we, our band, you know, we have this new record out, and we've been doing some promotional performances, and we just were at Pandora recently, and we saw some of the analytics behind how our music is consumed. And with Pandora, it's a non-interactive type of realm there. But I think that there's a lot of issues at play. One is obviously royalties and how they're collected, but another really important component about this discussion is not just royalties and access to accounting and all the mechanisms at play, but I think there's also access to data, because the data driving, you know, who listens to our music is oftentimes just as valuable. That can help us determine where we perform in the world, you know, where we should go, what demographics are actually, you know, who likes our music and why, which songs do they like. We actually have decided to maybe alter some of our set list for our touring this summer because of some of the analytics we got from them based on what songs people are really liking the most. You know, we want people to hear what they like, you know. And so a lot of the transparency with not just, like I say, not just accounting, it's also wanting to know data from all these sets of streaming and interactive and non-interactive services that's just as important to us.
Which service do you think provides you the best data?
Well, we don't really have a lot of data at this point. You know, what we would like is for all of them to make that available to us, and we just don't have that yet.
So I imagine that it's a full-time job, at least for a band member or perhaps a band member's spouse, to keep your profiles up on this rapidly expanding universe of platforms.
Yeah, and you know, it does just kind of feel like it feels like it's pretty hard to keep up at times, you know, because the technology keeps changing. And, you know, that's just a fact of life at this point. Or I was reading something Cory Doctorow said. He said when something goes from a problem to actually just a fact, you have to actually change your thinking, you know. So before it was a problem that streaming music was existing, and now it just obviously that's where the industry and the way people want to consume music is going. And so we all just need to kind of adjust so that people who, you know, from my standpoint, people who listen to our music, I just want to make it easy for them. And frankly, I know it's not a radio issue, but for us, you know, our band, we record a lot more music than we put on an album. It's actually exciting for us that we have a lot of different ways to continue to release material directly to people if they want to consume it. And, you know, that's fun for us.
Greg Sandoval, do you have a sense of which platforms are proving more popular with musicians and bands?
that's what I want to do, is say something now that would alienate all the other people at these other companies. I don't think there's any real winners yet, right? I mean, there's newcomers coming every day, and new services are cropping up. So I would not try to guess which is the most popular. I just know that, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here, that some of the artists that I talk to are not saying they're getting paid, or they're saying they're not getting paid by some of these services, in particular Pandora and Spotify. The big complaint, certainly from songwriters, composers, is that they don't make as much money from these services because these services don't pay mechanical royalties. The streaming services don't. And that's how they get paid. Now, that's not Spotify or Pandora's fault, right? Their streaming services and these mechanical licenses, they don't have to get them, or at least they don't have to pay them in the same way that they do with the download or a CD sale. So what's happening is the songwriter and the composer is kind of cut out of the equation. And I know that, you know, Linda Perry, for instance, she may not be a household name, but she wrote the song, a very popular song called Beautiful, that Christina Aguilera turned into a hit. That played millions of times, and she received, I guess the best figure to use is that it was played like hundreds of thousands of times in the first quarter of last year, and she made
$379. $379?
$379, according to her. And she's saying that she cannot make a living anywhere close, right? She says that she doesn't want to be rich, but most songwriters aren't rich. But to take that kind of hit is just devastating. So I think that we have to come up with new ways to compensate artists. And I know I'm not saying anything new. Everybody knows that. It's just at this point, no one's come close, really, to figuring it out.
Zach Rogue, I imagine that, like many musicians, you figured out you simply have to turn to other forms of revenue, whether that's, you know, writing for advertisements, you know, music for the next Nissan car, perhaps, or television or movies, if you're lucky enough to break into those businesses, or T-shirts.
Well, you know, that's kind of always been the case, really. I mean, it is a fact that there. At least right now, anyway, until these kind of, a lot of these kind of, like I say, these mechanisms of how streaming music is paid is kind of more favorable to the artists. We do have to rely on licensing. You know, that's really the only kind of, and touring revenue, you know, and licensing is what has allowed us to exist as a band. It's what allows us to buy new gear. It's what allows us to pay our studio rent and all those sorts of things, you know. And, yeah, you know, composing for commercials or for film or licensing, you know, existing music for television and film and commercial, that's kind of how we survive and how we exist.
Well, with that, let's head back to the phones. We've got Amruta in San Jose. Amruta, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question for the speakers, actually. My observation is what's happening to the music industry isn't very different from what has already happened to the movies and the TV content industry. With the influx of Netflix and Amazon, I guess, is also in the TV content streaming business, have we seen that influence the DVD sales or people going to the movie sales to consume that content? I think that's similarly what's happening to the music industry. Is it or is it not? And have they actually looked at it and made some conclusions or made some observations?
Larry Marcus, do you want to take that on?
Sure. Absolutely. The analog to digital transition has happened across many media. I mean, how many people go to the Yellow Pages now to look up a local merchant? It's been completely subsumed by the internet. I think one of the challenges on the music side is that the labels have always been very separated from the artists. And when you go back to the Napster days and all of a sudden there was piracy, at that time, everybody was taking their allowance and spending it on music. that's what I was doing. I was buying albums and albums, and the dollars, it was, you know, hundreds of dollars of music consumption per person. Well, now they started suing users and customers, and instead of adapting the way that music could be consumed and purchased, they started creating roadblocks and other issues. So part of it's just been, how has the music been packaged and merchandised? Only now, a decade later, are services coming to the foreground that really are solving your different needs. How do I listen to radio? How do I listen to songs on demand? How do I buy music digitally and consume it on my phone the way that I really want to consume it?
And as you've pointed out earlier, we're still really figuring out how to find the right mix, if you will, for royalties, to figure out who gets paid what and how.
Well, there's a lot of different schema that's out there. Radio as a promotional media and is something that helps artists be heard and discovered is adding a lot of value. But now with internet radio, there's royalties being paid where there weren't royalties being paid before.
Let's hear from some folks who have been writing in. Patrick writes on our website, as a musician with some long-running bands, I'm happy to see the reduction of CD waste, plastic jewel cases, remember those, but sad to see the possible loss of album art. With so much focus on digital downloads, bands will begin to invest less in the art of the album cover, insert, etc., and how it all works together. David Hyman, is that your sense, or do you think people really do want those additional add-ons, the art, the information that comes with the music?
I completely agree. I'm still an avid vinyl collector, and I listen to vinyl every night and cherish having those in my possession and holding them while I listen to music. In fact, my daughter Sophie's 9th birthday is coming up in a couple of weeks, and we're getting her a turntable, and she's incredibly excited to have the records. She watches me do it. And so I think there's a lot of value there, and I feel like consumers in the online realm have been at a great disservice compared to physical media in that regard. There are some exciting companies coming out, one I'm consulting for called OpenAura.net, that's working on fixing that issue. They're building tools to sell to the digital streaming music providers that will allow them to enhance the visual aspect and metadata aspect of their services.
Well, now let's hear, this is really a comment, not a question, from Roy from Pope Valley, who writes, don't forget many people who live in rural areas cannot reliably stream music in their cars. iTunes and CDs ripped to their devices are the only dependable sources of high-quality music reproduction for us. And we have Mickey, who writes in, although I was an early fan of Pandora paying the annual subscription fee, I've dropped the service and gone to programmed radio stations. In the end, the Pandora stations are boring. Radio stations, good ones, program the music, shaking up the mix. They have personality. I suppose that's a direct attack for you, Larry Marcus, to deal with.
Well, I wonder how long ago that listener stopped. It's always evolving, and I've heard from people early on who said there were too many repeats or it wasn't personalized enough for me. That's been evolving a lot, so I hope she'll go and try again. That's the core of what's really being worked on.
We have here a comment from Facebook. Marcello writes, I used to have Spotify Premium, but switched a couple of weeks ago to Google Music All Access. Much better radio selection algorithms. My entire library of older and foreign CDs uploaded next to their subscription music. It has a good HTML5 web client. The Spotify client software for PCs is annoying and a resource hog, though now they're also rolling out a web client. He continues, you can tell Marcello is a very sophisticated listener. Zach Rogue, I understand you listen to a lot of music online as a consumer, not just a musician. What's your sense of what works and why?
Well, I think that there should be, you know, in my mind, I think there should be a quiet acknowledgement that, you know, as great as some of these algorithm-based services are, you know, I don't see any substitution for human curation still, because you know, that kind of discovery is something only people can really do. You know, I listen to a lot of different services. You know, I use Pandora, I use Spotify, Rhapsody. You know, I use a lot of those services at home. And, you know, for me personally, I kind of like to find things on my own or, you know, listen to internet radio stations that I think are good. And the beautiful thing about it is I can listen to Triple J in Australia, you know, and listen to what's happening there. I can listen to KCRW in L.A. I can kind of listen to a lot of different stuff. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing is this kind of this access.
You know, it's an interesting question. I'll put it to you, David Hyman. Different DJs, you know, who have a following are using different services. I think KCRW, if you really want to get their DJs, you have to listen to the KCRW app, whether that's, you know, on a smartphone or an iPad. And then you have SoundCloud where, you know, if you want to listen to the BBC's Giles Peterson, you should be checking out SoundCloud. Is it a mistake for DJs to pick one single platform? Should they be platform agnostic?
I mean, ideally, I think a lot of them probably don't have a choice, right? If you're getting paid by, you know, KCRW, that's where you're going to appear. And I'm sure some of them are contractually obligated to specific places. There are some new opportunities. There's some aggregators like Stitcher and TuneTo that are pulling all of these stations together and making it easier for consumers to go to one place, one app that lets them access DJs from a multitude of traditional terrestrial radio stations. And, you know, I use those personally. I find them to be very helpful. You know, there's a lot of choice for the non-professional DJ. If I was a non-professional DJ today that didn't have my own show on the radio and was bound to a specific app or a specific station, I'd probably be using things like SoundCloud, which make it really easy to upload your own music and embed that code anywhere on the internet.
We should also give a shout-out to TuneIn and iHeart, which are probably the two big aggregators of the different terrestrial radio streams. iHeart is Clear Channel, and TuneIn is a Silicon Valley company.
Matt from San Francisco writes, I listen mostly online to SomaFN.com. The stations are programmed by music directors. I like it this way because, number one, I hear music I like but don't have to choose what to listen to. Number two, I don't get barraged with ads or social media nonsense. And I'm wondering, Larry Marcus, if you can talk about what studies have been done to sort of figure out what's the choke point for listeners in terms of how much advertising they'll bear?
Sure. Well, if you're not listening to ads and you're not paying, then whoever's providing that to you is really just hemorrhaging cash by providing that to you. So you're almost taking from them. For listeners, there's probably an ad load. I think in terrestrial radio, they're doing around a dozen ads. It's multiple minutes, I think 7 minutes per hour or more. And Pandora is doing a minute or so. It moves around depending on the listener and the demo. But listeners actually on TV, sorry, watchers of TV are barraged by 20 minutes of ads in an hour. So there's really a lot of ad load tolerance, and there's a lot more room to expand advertising without listeners feeling like there isn't a fair value exchange for something they're getting for free.
Although I imagine if we had someone from Netflix here, they'd say that part of the reason they have such a big audience is a lot of people don't want 20 minutes of advertising an hour.
Well, that's right. And people are paying the monthly subscription fee, you know, $10, $15, $20 a month for the capability to access that on-demand media.
If you don't want ads,
Pandora, you can subscribe to it for $4 a month right off of your iPhone, or for $3 a month directly off the web.
And Spotify as well, a subscription service.
That's right. Spotify for $10, all the subscription services for $10, you're able to get all you can eat, whatever you can access, and that model works well for them. So I think for people who want to pay, you have tremendous access. The real issue is that the people who are generally willing to pay for media is in the single-digit percentage points versus people who want it for free.
Is that your understanding, David Hyman? It's that small, the folks who are willing to pay rather than suffer ads?
I think that's always been the case. I mean, even before the internet, you know, you had terrestrial radio and you had the people who bought CDs, and there was an incredible disproportion. Disproportionate percentage of people who were just content with radio. But, you know, that doesn't mean that the on-demand market globally isn't a significant market. You've got iTunes doing $5 billion a year off the people who want to pay for on-demand music. And I think as these services continue to improve, as services like Spotify and Moog and RDIO continue to improve and provide additional value to the consumer above just a search field, having to type in the name of a song or an album that you know and click play, but really improve the discovery component, improve the programming component, I think they'll be able to capture more of the audience. But programming is key to this. Consumers are overwhelmed. They're faced with 17 million songs and a search window, and it's very often good luck. And they haven't done a great job of making it easier for you to navigate through all that content. As they continue to improve that, I think you'll see more and more people paying for these on-demand services.
Let's turn now to Rick in Oakland.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I just quickly wanted to bring up the sort of difference in libraries that these services have. I know, I think it's definitely changing, but I know Spotify tends to have more of like the smaller local kind of indie stuff that I kind of wouldn't find on Pandora. And I also wanted a comment from your speakers on whether or not the sort of upswing in DJ culture and the reemergence of electronic music is, and its effect on pop, is sort of how it's pushing things in, and specifically in terms of, as they were speaking about before, the higher music quality files. I know Beatport offers WAV downloads as opposed to MP3, and when you're DJing, at least if you're a good DJ, you definitely want to use those higher quality files. So I just like the responses on those two points.
Larry Marcus, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, well, on the first one, it's really interesting how there's always talk around this service has 10 million tracks and this song service has 20 million tracks. You know, users don't really want an infinite number of tracks, but they, and I don't want that. I want to just have that great music now. And so to your second point, with, you know, interesting emerging music or whatnot, the Pandora database is highly curated, and part of what makes it interesting is they're really picking what's going to go in there by hand, and it's preventing some things that you wouldn't want to listen to anyway from going in. And they're pushing really hard on bringing in new genres like EDM as well.
Any thoughts on that, David Hyman?
Yeah, I'd concur.
you concur.
Know, yeah, I mean, you know, servicing the market of people who are DJing is so minuscule. It's just not enough of a market that any of these services really cater to that audience. I'd imagine a lot of those DJs are probably best served, you know, buying the tracks, buying the highest resolution tracks they can, probably by getting the CD. CD is still the way that consumers get highest resolution today. There are some new services coming out like HD Tracks, which I'm really bullish on, which are also pushing high resolution files for people who are DJing or want that better quality.
It is an interesting point to make that even as all of these different platforms are trying to reach the bigger markets, that there is a lot out there for the music lover, for the audiophile, for you know, somebody who's got a what might be considered a niche interest, they can still get their needs met. Thank you, Rick in Oakland. Let's turn now to Al in North Carolina.
Yeah, I want to bring up a point I don't think we've touched on is regarding this, how this is being delivered to the consumer, end user. I mean, if you think about it, no one even talked about satellite radio. You're paying this astronomical amount to get music, in your car. But so here is the breakdown comes in. If I'm a, you know, if I have a family, I have teenagers and a young one. Young one wants to have Netflix. I can't even change your mind about that. So I have to pay Netflix $8.99. Then I have to have a music service. Well, if you look at the music services, the one that's going to win is going to separate themselves, is the one that I can actually get out of my house and look at my equipment. And what do we have? iPod and iPhone. And obviously Androids can do this too. But the reason that iRadio can be significant, and if it's done the right way, you can win. And I would say that what I would like to see is that how do you take that music with you, meaning that in a podcast level that you've maybe downloaded already 5-6 different channels that you know what I like, and then I'm able to take that with me on the road, because now I don't have to pay a huge membership to a satellite radio.
Well, Al, I'm going to stop you there because we just have a few seconds. David Hyman, do you want to answer that really quickly?
Yeah, I mean, all of these services are already available on the iPhone, whether it's Pandora, Spotify, or Moog. A lot of the services, the subscription services like Spotify, Moog, RDIO, allow unlimited downloads to the phone as part of the subscription. So you're not completely tethered to the cloud. You can download to local storage and fill the entire memory inside your phone with music and have that locally, so you're not always reliant on the carrier and your coverage.
Thank you, David. We have to wrap it up there. I want to thank all of our guests, David Hyman, founder and CEO of Moog, Greg Sandoval, senior reporter for The Verge, Larry Marcus, director of Walden Venture Capital, and Zach Rogue, the founder of the Oakland-based indie band Rogue Wave. We're hearing that music as we go out of the show now. It's a song called College off of Rogue Wave's new album, Nightingale Floors. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.